Good afternoon. It's 3 p.m. You're listening to Afternoon Classics here on KRVS. A big round of thanks to everyone who pledged their support during our spring fundraiser. We couldn't do it without you, so thanks so much for all of the support out there. Coming up at 4 o'clock, All Things Considered from NPR News. We begin the hour by heading into the interview studio with Judith Merriweather.
And joining me by telephone is Sadie Hoagland, who is a professor here at UL Lafayette and is actually currently director of the Creative Writing Program. She is well-published. She recently, a couple of years ago, had a book of short stories published called American Grief in Four Stages, and we spoke about that book, Sadie. It was a wonderful book. And now you are coming out with your first novel called Strange Children. It will come out in mid-May. And so first, congratulations on that book. That must be very exciting to have a novel come out.
Thank you. It is really exciting. This project is something I worked on for a long time, so it's really fun to finally see it hit the shelves.
Yeah, like you're, you know, so it's so interesting to hear how long writers work on something. And so you must feel like you've been, you know, raising this child and it's ready to go into the world. And you did work on this book for quite a while. I think it's been in your mind for a number of years.
Yes, I started it as short stories back in 2009, so a long time. And I just wrote, you know, 3 to 4 short stories and sort of left it at that. And then I couldn't quite let it go. I kept thinking about the world of those stories and the way they were connected and the way those characters were connected. So I returned to it a couple of years later and wrote a novella and then thought maybe I'm done. And then, you know, a year later thought, no, I'm not done. It still needs to kind of build more. This world needs to grow. So it became a novel.
Well, and I think as we talk about some of the characters in the book and their situations, people will understand why it continued to grow and why it had such a strong hold on you. The title is Strange Children, which is from a biblical verse, I believe, maybe one of the Psalms. It references strange children. Did that title or psalm strike you afterwards, or was that something you thought about as you were creating these children?
It actually happened afterwards. I was looking through, at that point, and I'd written quite a bit of the book, but I was looking through both the Book of Mormon and the Bible to think about some of the language used in order to build up some of the language in the book, particularly of the prophet character. And I came across that, it's Psalm 144, send thine hand from above, rid me and deliver me out of great waters from the hand of strange children. And it just fit the book so well because these children are strange in many ways in the fact that they live in sort of a fringe community, a polygamous community, and also because they are honest in their narrations and their perspectives. And they have kind of, there's a few of them that I consider changeling characters. And so it seemed to just fit really well with the sort of way that I conceived of the young narrators of the book.
Well, and you just mentioned a couple things we should let people know. You mentioned looking through the Book of Mormon, and you mentioned a polygamous cult. So you never use the word Mormon in this book. It's very interesting how you frame this cult. It is a polygamous cult, and I think many of us are aware of these fringe polygamous cults. They often pop up in the news, and I think that was mentioned in some of the materials, press materials. You know that we have those images of FBI raiding compounds and seeing certain images of people dressed in old-fashioned clothes and hairstyles and lots of children looking like they, you know, came out of, you know, 100 years ago. But you, very interesting how you frame this. You know, you are aware that there is some connection with Mormonism, but even when they talk about the book, it's never called the Book of Mormon. How did you want people to think of this group that these children, and really they're older, they're young teenagers, really, like between the ages of 12 and 16. How did you want people to imagine this place in this group of people? You know, you didn't want us to think, oh, Mormons. You didn't. What were you trying to create?
That's a great question. So I definitely, the community in the book definitely have a relationship with the reality of FLDS communities. There are some similarities, and I did a lot of research into FLDS communities, which is the fundamentalist LDS, which are the communities you've seen on the news. But I also really wanted the reader to not bring too many preconceptions into the book about, you know, things they heard in the news or read about these communities, and what they kind of had assumed about the characters and people that would be in these communities. I wanted to build a world up, both from my own imagination, but also for my characters to live in sort of free of bias and free of the reader's bias. What I really wanted people to kind of think about is that we have these, when I first started writing this book, polygamy was certainly being sort of fetishized through reality TV and through sort of that Big Love show. And people seemed very interested in kind of the voyeurism of polygamy and the idea that it was so different from our world and our belief system. And it certainly is, but what I really wanted to challenge was the idea that we would be so different if we had grown up there. I think we sometimes get a little comfortable and think, well, I would never do that. I would never live in this world. But I think if you'd grown up there, you certainly would, and you certainly would have some of those beliefs. So I think I just wanted to disorient the reader in a productive way, so that the reality would be kind of new and fresh to them, even though it does have a correspondence with our world.
Right, because you think when you see a situation like that on the news or on popular media, you think, well, why don't they just get out? Why don't they just leave? You know, how can you stay in this? And you're right. You make us very less comfortable with making those decisions in this book. But you're also, you're not shying away from the evident violence and trauma that can happen within such a closed community. And so you're asking us to hold both elements, you know, trying to be both understanding and compassionate and horrified at the same time. And you do this, and interesting, you know, you talked about these people, these characters living with you for a long time. You do that through, I believe, 8 different voices in the book. How did you come up with these different characters to get us to open up to all of these facets of such a community? How did you choose which elements?
Yeah, that's a good question too. I think there's 2 sisters in the book, Emma and Amalu, that sort of center the book. And for me, they, you know, they could hold a lot of their narration. They could tell a lot of the story. But what was really important to me in writing this book is to think about identity and identity within communities and first-person narration as this sort of anchoring down of identity, and especially for these narrators that are coming of age, anchoring down who they are within their community by sort of how they tell their story. So I think the fact that that the story needed to be told from multiple points of view became clear to me, because I was also interested in this community, so your listeners know, it's sort of falling apart as the novel continues on, both from external pressures, but also from internal strife. And so it was important to me that you had different versions of the story that was going on, and even maybe some tension in between the truths that people told. Actually, one of the traditions of LDS is to kind of bear testimony. So I thought about that phrase a lot when I was writing this book and what that means to sort of bear witness and kind of give your testimony of what's happening, and kind of to invoke some kind of sacred, or even to invoke even God in the kind of way that you speak, to say that you're thinking and speaking as if from revelation. I was really interested in that. So the form is part of, I think, some of the thematics of the book, and sort of reflects the thematics of the book. And then as I got to know more of the characters, I thought, oh, this person has to have a voice. We have to hear from them because their perspective is slightly different. Like, for example, there's the character of Cadence, who is not actually someone who grows up in the community, but someone who is very much vulnerable and alone and is adopted by the community.
She's fascinating.
To have that perspective. Yeah.
She's not a child, but yet you include her voice in there, mm-hmm. although there's a childlike quality to her. Well, that's interesting that you talk about wanting to express, to help us understand the extreme sacredness of this community. Because I think when we do see those images that we mentioned earlier of people being let out of a compound, you know, black FBI cars, you forget about the core of spirituality and sacredness that does exist for many within the community. And you show that very clearly through the way these children think and talk and express themselves. It's not just like they are being they're not just captive in a place aching to get out. They believe in their heart, and they think about the sacred and angels and God all the time. It's in everything mm-hmm. they do, everything they express, it feels like. And you do a really good job of that. And I think I was put in mind, you mentioned earlier you didn't want us to rest in our perceptions and prejudices about a certain group. And the way you described how some of these children, teenagers, thought and had visions even reminded me of, my own understanding of Catholic mysticism and very young people, young teenagers having visions and, mm-hmm. Going off into the desert and the wilderness and becoming hermits. And, that was very commonplace when you read about the early church fathers and mothers and people just regularly having visions. It was something expected. And so you presented it in such a, out of the mouths of babes, out of the mouths of children. Mm-hmm. It was so natural. It felt so natural to hear them talk that way about the celestial and God and what heaven was like and how they understood you would get to heaven. And then, of course, one of the sisters you mentioned, Emma, who's, a fascinating character, she actively begins to, become, it's hard to describe her transformation. What were you thinking with her? Because she really does explode some of our understanding of how that mm-hmm. kind of a cult exists. What were you hoping she would make us understand?
So Emma she was actually the first narrator I wrote, and I think she is in many ways the most dogmatic and the most rebellious, which is an interesting combination because she takes the idea of revelation so much to heart that at the age of 12, she really believes that she can just take all of that information that the elders are giving her and that the prophet is giving her, and she can just appropriate it. So she feels like she has the power to do that, so that even though the mechanism through which she's acting is faith, she's still sort of acting on her own volition in sort of acts of rebellion. And the first act in the book, your listeners who haven't read it know, is that she has an illicit relationship with a male, a young male, a teenage boy in the community, and he's exiled. And then she's married off to his father and gives birth to his father's child a year later.
And she's 12.
But she is very young. And so she is sort of this wild card in the sense that she continues to interpret the world and the language of the prophet and the power in the community in a way that's beneficial to her. And she continues to kind of pivots her narrative according to her own desires throughout the book. And in the end, she does come to claim some power. Because that original act between her and Jeremiah, the exiled boy, has quite a falling out because he commits a crime that then reverberates back onto mm-hmm. the community. Mm-hmm. And so Yeah, go ahead.
With just the ripples. You're talking about reverberating the ripples. Everything they think and imagine and do just ripples, and you get this sense of it becoming more and more intense as the book goes on. These aren't just gentle ripples. These are upsetting so many relationships.
Yes, and I think with her, I just wanted, I wanted both redemption for her status as what would be a completely powerless young woman in a community where the men hold all of that power. And I wanted to give her more, find a way through the narrative to give her more than just what would probably more realistically be her lot as a 12-year-old girl in a community like this.
So you've already mentioned some things that are kind of taboo in our world too, but obviously within that sect, they're even more so. And the consequences, as you said, she's married off to his father, he is exiled. But there are even more violent things that happen within that sect. And a lot of it seems to happen because of the cult of personality, that it's not just a part of that sect, but it comes about because one person is allowed to have so much power. Can you describe how that violence weaves into this community and ultimately begins to unravel it?
Sure. Yeah, I think that is something that has happened in reality in communities like this as well, where one person, the prophet, usually has the center of power, and there are prophets that have abused the power more so than others. And I think when we think of Warren Jeffs, when we think polygamy, that is certainly an example of that. And so that starts to kind of upset the balance in this community as well. And that's part of the internal strife. It's just that when you give the man the power to speak through the voice of God, it's very hard to argue against what he chooses to say as God, right? Because then you're arguing against God. So I think that sort of mechanism sets up an easy susceptibility to imbalances of power.
And it's not just not wanting to argue against. There are some extremely serious consequences that happen. This atonement of the blood that this prophet seems to take so seriously, and people are killed because of perceived slights against the prophet, or, you know, they're not participating. And the family, one of the voices of the children is a young boy named Manti. Is that how you pronounce
Manti.
His name?
Mm-hmm.
Manti. And his family doesn't fit the picture of what we think of, either in a traditional Mormon situation or the more fundamentalist ones. They're kind of on the outskirts. And but yet they're still a part of it, and really terrible things happen to them. You see them as incredibly vulnerable. Why did you create his family? His family seems fascinating to me in the book.
A couple things. I think a couple of things come with Manti that I really appreciated. One is that I think we think of these communities as completely homogenized and there's the prophet and everybody else, but there are hierarchies and class in these communities as much as any other community. So I think that's one of the sort of points I wanted to make with Manti and his family, is that there are people that are, you know, living in sort of a disenfranchised, marginalized state.
Even within a community.
In these communities as well. But also I think Manti and his family, he's what I kind of pictured him as, like Puck.
Yes.
Like he just has in Shakespeare, he just has this kind of changeling way that he moves about the community. And I'm obviously interested in outsiders, as this whole book is a reflection of. But I'm really interested in the way that outsiders can move. And so his narration was important to me because he can point out the vulnerabilities in other families. He can point out the tenderness in families. So he had like a very specific function in terms of the kinds of things that he could show us about the community and the kinds of things that family could show us about the community, both their harsh judgment, but also their charitable nature and the way that they consider them a part of the community, even as they are very clearly different than them. So I think he had that function as well. But he is, his father is a victim of blood atonement, you mentioned, which was a really interesting moment in the writing of this book for me. My brother is a lawyer in Utah, and one day we were talking about my polygamous book project, and he told me, well, you know, to serve on a jury, certain juries in Utah, you have to answer, you have to fill out your survey and questionnaire. And one of the questions still to this day is, do you believe in blood atonement, which is a very old doctrine. And the fact that it would still be, relevant in criminal trials today here in Utah just completely blew my mind. So it started me down a lot of research on that subject. And so it definitely made its way into the book and accounts for some of the violence, for sure.
Yeah, that is very, very powerful. His voice, Manti's voice, and his family's story within the context of that. I want to tell listeners who are, I'm sure, finding themselves fascinated by this book, my guest by telephone is Sadie Hoagland, who is a creative writing professor here at UL Lafayette, currently directs the creative writing program concentration at both master's and PhD program here at the university. Her first novel is coming out in May. It's titled Strange Children, and it's told from the view of eight different, mostly young teenagers in a polygamous sect in Utah, and how the community kind of begins to unravel, and the perceptions of all these different children, some from the outside, some who have been banished, some who have been abused, just lots of different perspectives in the novel. So I'm sure that's not an easy thing to have these, to weave these, all of these different voices into a common narrative and a common purpose. You know, you want this movement that happens, otherwise it's just eight short stories. How did you wrestle with that? And what did you know you wanted all of their different voices, where you wanted those voices to take us?
It was definitely challenging. It was an exciting project, but this is my debut novel, and I've since written a draft of another novel that's just in third-person narration for the most part and chronological, and I couldn't believe how easy it was to write compared to Strange Children, because it did take a lot of charting out of characters, balancing when the characters spoke, so they would kind of speak within rhythms of the book, but also kind of thinking about when I wanted certain things to be revealed and who should reveal them. So it took a lot of kind of big picture charting out through the book. And then there were some moments that were a little bit more just, oh, that's so obvious. Like, for example, the character of Jeremiah, he is exiled, so he's the only perspective that's in third person. And that seemed really clear to me when I thought about it, just because he needs to, he loses all of his agency when he's kicked out of the community. And I really wanted that to be clear in a formal way in the book. And so I didn't want to give him a voice. I wanted his voice. You kind of hear it through the third person. But I wanted it to be clear that even as he is a predator in this book, he is also a victim. And that kind of cycle of victim and predator is really something I wanted to kind of trouble in this book, partly because of the systemic abuse of the community. So that sort of decision was really easy, but other decisions were more difficult and took a lot more sort of juggling and planning and revising and moving. But it was fun. I'm glad I did it.
Oh, I think a lot of people who read it will be very glad you did it. I couldn't put it down, and their voices are so compelling. And for a variety of reasons, I mean, you live through these tragic, abusive moments, but then there are these moments where all they can think of are the tender, nostalgic, happy times that they've had, and you're trying to hold all of that in your heart as you're reading this book. You know, there's just some lovely moments where they're, and Jeremiah's not the only one who's, well, he's banished, but there's a young girl named Mercy Ann who was taken away from the compound with her family, I believe, and they were put with foster families. And she's remembering everything that she had, all of the connections. And even though it's just, I think if we looked over that town, it would look like a very dry, dusty, unappealing place. But they describe these moments as one only can with a family situation where you love it because it has been where you've been nurtured. And you hear that so strongly in not just her, but Jeremiah. Jeremiah looks back on his time as a child and remembers it with great love and passion almost. They can't leave the place that they have been raised, where their mother loved them and fed them. And I think you illustrate that so well when most of us, again, looking in on, you know, a compound like that would say, why don't they just leave? And you make us understand why that doesn't happen so easily. And just beautiful, very poetic moments in so many of these children where they describe, you know, just the ordinary things, what they do with their siblings and, you know, the animals and the food and their mother loving them. And it's just an incredible mix of emotions that you sustain in this book.
Thank you.
It was, and you hold that till the end. It's, there is a denouement, there is kind of an end, but yet you are still left with all of these same emotions and you can't come to an easy judgment about these children or what they each choose to do. Or and we haven't mentioned the ghost. That's one of the voices, a young teenage ghost. How did that, because that raises this to a different level. You could have done it without her, but what does she do? She is a complete outsider whose life has been affected by one of them. What does she do, and why did you want this element of the supernatural?
So I wanted to have this entity, this narrating entity, that could move around and give us insight into some of the adults, which the children can't as much. So that's one thing she can do, is she can visit the prophet and she can witness some of the actions of the adult characters with more intimacy than the children can. But I also wanted to have these private images of the characters. So for one example she gives is that after a character is dealing with the after effects and post-trauma of sexual assault for quite a while after her assault. And one of the things that narrator can do is kind of bear witness. Mm-hmm. There's that term again. Mm-hmm. And sort of tell the reader what the character really can't tell us in her own words. The sort of suffering that she is enduring. And she does tell us, but she is more guarded than we see her vulnerability in this image through the ghost narrator, who can just kind of watch her without being seen. So I liked that idea of this narrator that could watch without being seen. But she also gives, you know, at the beginning of the book, she gives a very big picture of what the setting looks like and what characters kind of look like in some intimate moments. So you kind of get this different way to add characterization to the novel, which I think is somewhat of a breath of air from the first-person narrations that dominate the book.
I don't know if I'd use the word fresh air. It's she was there was a interesting emotion you felt. I mean, almost like in, you mentioned Shakespeare earlier, but in these elements when the supernatural comes in and there's this definite change in texture and change in emotion when this character is introduced. You know, they do serve a wonderful practical purpose, but they create emotions as well. And I found it fascinating, you know, her voice all of them at the end, because they've all gone through so much and come to another place, but it's not their ending place. And you can't really rest in your understanding of what's actually going to happen. And the ghost feels, I don't know, I felt even more uncertain about the ghost at the end. She had, you weren't sure where her redemption was there. And there's, because there's both redemption and still waiting, because they are all so young They are all so mm-hmm. young at the end of the book still, and you don't have a clear idea of where they will all go, where their spirits, their energies, their emotions, and the ghost is, you know, it's a wonderful touch, and it leaves you wanting to know more about her. I mean, you do learn her backstory, a very tragic backstory. So how did you feel at the end with all of your characters? Were you satisfied with them at the end? Did you want to write a sequel? You know, Strange Children 2?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think what's left unsettled at the end, and you do know a few things. You know the characters that get out, and you know the characters that are likely going to stay, and you know that there has been a sense of redemption for the ghost narrator, but also for some of the other characters as well. And there's a sense of starting over for the community, for sure. Mm-hmm. I'm not giving anything away when I say that, because mm-hmm. it's in the prologue at the beginning that some major shifts in power have happened, and it's a major moment of reckoning for the community at the end of the book. And I do think that is, you know, somewhat realistic. As much as I would have loved to sort of free them all, I think that some of those characters' lives are bound to that piece of earth. Mm-hmm. And also to that lifestyle, and that they want to maintain that lifestyle and maintain those beliefs. I think one of the interesting parts of my research was meeting a young man who had been exiled from the community at a very young age, which is really common among FLDS communities because polygamy creates a surplus of males. And he drove me around his community and kind of gave me a tour of his childhood, basically. And a couple of things struck me about that conversation. The first was that he was still living really close by in like an abandoned motel. It was a very strange situation, and looking for work, and he'd been working on oil rigs. But one of the things he said to me is, I can't imagine a better way to grow up. So you get that, mm-hmm. some of that nostalgia that you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. Definitely was inspired by him. But another sense was that this was a community that was currently in the same kind of disorganization that you find the community at the end of Strange Children. They had basically they'd split into two different factions. Some were following Warren Jeffs from prison, and some were following a new leader. There was a lot of sort of trying to figure out what to do next. Hmm. And some people were leaving, but a lot of people weren't. So I think some of the ending of the book feels really realistic to me. Mm-hmm. And I do think that one of the things that the ghost narrator tries to do is to really reach across that bridge to the living. And I think at the end, she feels like she's had some success.
Mm-hmm. They have heard her. Some of them have.
Yes.
Well, Sadie, it's an amazing work, and I hope people have the opportunity to read it. Again, if you are just tuning in, my guest is Sadie Hoagland. She's a professor here at UL Lafayette. She teaches in the English department and in the creative writing concentration. She has just published her first novel. It's called Strange Children. It's out in mid-May. And people have gotten very good about searching for things online, but it is published by, I believe, Red Hen Press.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So you could look for that, or just Strange Children, and it would pop up. I don't know if you're going to have some kind of book event, Sadie. Is there, everything's virtual these days. Are you doing a virtual book opening?
I am. So if you go to my website, sadiehoagland.com, you can see the book and you can find links to order it. But I'll also have up there a link to the launch, which is virtual, and it's on May 18th at 5 p.m. Central Time, and or 7 p.m. Central Time, excuse me. And I'd be really excited to see some Lafayette folks there. It'll be a virtual kind of in conversation with another author.
Well, I think a lot of people will be very interested, you know, because, and maybe this is something I saw in some other press, you know, someone made the comment that it's still a bit taboo to write about polygamous cults, or, you know, I don't want to say just Mormons, but these more fundamentalist cults. Why is that? What is that? Are we still, we don't want to trespass on someone else's spirituality, or what is it that prevents people from writing more about it?
That's a good question. I think there's a lot of discomfort surrounding it. I think part of it is the spirituality factor. I think part of it is that a lot of polygamous communities have issues with systemic abuse, which is certainly addressed in the novel. But I think that also makes people uncomfortable, which is understandable. And I think in general, it's just a world that seems really foreign to people. I grew up in Utah, so I knew a lot about LDS culture and doctrine, but I did have to do an immense amount of research on how that differs from LDS, FLDS doctrine and polygamous doctrine. And so I think some of it is just, it's so much outside of our culture, even though there are many polygamous sects throughout our country and in all over the place that are kind of existing alongside of us.
And in addition to just growing up in a Mormon neighborhood, you actually had an ancestor, a great-great-great-great-grandmother, who was one of the original pioneers in Utah. Is that?
Yes.
And so did that give you more courage to wade into the subject?
I do think so. I think that I was always fascinated with polygamy growing up because it was part of our sort of origin myth as, you know, this non-Mormon family in this really Mormon area of Utah. And my grandmother would say, well, we're not Mormon because my great-grandmother was Mormon and she was a first wife and she became really unhappy with polygamy. And, you know, the family legend is that, you know, the third wife got new curtains when she wanted them, and that was the the straw that broke the camel's back. And so we left the church at that moment, the curtain moment. And so it sort of was this part of this kind of really important story to me as a kid as to why I wasn't Mormon like every other kid in my school. But it also, we had a polygamous family living in our neighborhood. And so my friend and I would ride our bikes over to watch the children, and they were very involved with they had farm animals in their yard. And they wore that, you know, kind of really traditional polygamous clothing that you described at the beginning of the interview. And we would just kind of watch them. And we really wanted them to talk to us because we were so curious about their lives. But, of course, they were pretty trained not to talk to outsiders. Mm-hmm. But I became pretty fascinated at that moment. And so I did feel in some ways that this was a story I could tell.
The curtains, that could have been you.
Yeah, exactly. And I do think, in one very realistic sense that there are plenty of narratives written by polygamous survivors that you can find. Mm. And if that's what you're looking for, that's certainly what you should look for. But this is a story, I think, that this particular novel has to be told from an outside perspective.
Right. Again, just beautiful, so compelling and powerful, and you can't rest in any one preconceived idea of what a group like this must be or how it would be growing up in one. So just great credit to you as a writer and how you envision this book. Again, the book title is Strange Children by my guest, Sadie Hoagland. There will be an online book launch May 18th, and you can find a link to that book launch through Sadie Hoagland's website, sadiehoagland.com. Well, Sadie, thanks so much, and we look forward to your future work. You've been quite busy since you've started teaching and writing here in our community, and we're very, very grateful for your talent and for sharing that with all of us in these books. So we look forward to having you in the future with future endeavors, but we're so glad that this has come out and people can find out more again at your website. Thank you so much, Sadie.
Thank you so much, Judith. It's always a pleasure.
And thanks so much, Judith. We'll be back in a few minutes with a rundown of the events calendar. Next up, pianist Andrea Schiff performs the piano sonata in A Major by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.